From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the University of Michigan tries to change course in its troubled and weirdly successful athletic program.
If Michigan had fired him for cause, I think he could have fought that. He probably could have laid some things out that would not have been very flattering for some other people at Michigan.
Also, we've got a bit of Michigan history for you about how some civic-minded women banded together to start a supercharged proto-book club.
It was a small group of about three or four women. It grew to eight, and for a few years, they would gather in one another's homes, sewing, and one woman would read aloud.
Plus, jobs for teenagers. In this economy, we're running the numbers on teen employment for this summer.
The lack of experience they get when we've got a weaker economy ends up shaping them for a lifetime.
Those stories coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what it takes for the kids to get a summer job in 2026.
When you have a high adult unemployment rate, you're going to have older people competing with teens for the exact same job.
Economist Betsy Stevenson is dropping by for a look at teen employment numbers. That's ahead, but first, the churn continues at University of Michigan Athletics. Athletic Director Ward Manuel has announced that he will be leaving his post at the end of the calendar year. His 10 years plus with Michigan have been marked by some very memorable highs, national championships for football and men's basketball, but they've also featured many moments of controversy involving Michigan's teams. Manuel's confirmed departure Monday arrived at the same time as the university's release of some findings from a $12 million independent investigation into former head football coach Sherrone Moore's relationship with a subordinate. For more on Manuel's announced exit and what it means for Wolverine Athletics, Austin Meek of The Athletic is here. Austin, welcome back to Stateside.
Hi, April.
So, we know Ward Manuel as a former Michigan football player. This is a guy who was on one of Bo Schembechler's teams. Longtime executive. You know, he had a post at the University of Connecticut, UConn, another high-profile school before he came back to Ann Arbor. What kinds of things did you hear about Ward Manuel as a manager?
Well, I think one thing that separates Ward Manuel from some other athletic directors is he never really aspired to be anywhere but Michigan. As you mentioned, he played football at Michigan. This was his home. He was not an athletic director who was always looking for the next job. This was the place he wanted to be, and he was at Michigan for almost 11 years. He had a lot of success as Michigan's athletic director, but as a manager, I think some of his shortcomings came out in the findings that Michigan released from the Jenner and Block investigation, particularly in the culture of Michigan's athletic departments. There have been a lot of issues at Michigan in recent years, NCAA investigations, legal issues. And the common theme, I think, that we saw laid out in these findings was that Michigan was often slow to respond to allegations of misconduct involving athletic department employees. I think that ultimately ended up at the feet of Ward Manuel and is part of the reason why he will not continue as Michigan's athletic director.
Austin, what is your sense of why Ward Manuel is leaving now? As you mentioned, there's been this drumbeat of problems over the past few years. And here he is, maybe, you know, calling his own shots in the manner of his departure.
I think the timing of Ward Manuel's departure speaks to the complexity of this whole situation. I think a lot of Michigan fans wondered, why didn't this happen sooner when all of the information came out in December about Sherrone Moore, his firing, and later his arrest? A lot of Michigan fans felt like Ward Manuel's time had come at Michigan, but he remained in his job. Michigan commissioned this external investigation to gather facts about the Sherrone Moore situation and the broader culture of the athletic department. And then after receiving those findings, Michigan had a decision to make about Ward Manuel. But I think this was a negotiation. Ward Manuel also had leverage in this situation. And I think his negotiated exit, which is going to come at the end of this year, is a fact that both sides, Ward Manuel and Michigan, had an incentive to try to reach an agreement that would allow Ward Manuel to leave, not exactly on his own terms, but at least with a little more dignity than just being fired on the spot after Michigan received these findings.
Austin, can you say more about what you mean when you say that Manuel himself may have had some leverage over the school? Are you saying that, you know, nobody suggested that he was handling these things inappropriately at an earlier point?
I think everybody made mistakes in these situations. Ward Manuel made mistakes in how he handled the allegations with Sharon Moore. Other people at Michigan made mistakes. And the leverage that Ward Manuel had really was, if Michigan had fired him for cause, I think he could have fought that. And he probably could have laid some things out that would not have been very flattering for some other people at Michigan. So I think there's an incentive for everybody to come to an agreement to resolve this somewhat quietly. A lot of things in that report, Michigan is attempting to keep quiet. They did not release detailed findings from the report. They just released some kind of top line takeaways. So I think this speaks to all sides having an incentive to keep some of that private, or to attempt to keep some of that private. And I think that's where the leverage comes from. But I think there's still going to be pressure on Michigan to release more of these findings. I think a lot of Michigan fans are going to feel that they deserve to know more about what happened here beyond just the really basic takeaways that Michigan released this week.
To that end, do you think that we will see more of what's in that report in the weeks and months to come?
It feels inevitable to me that there is more that will come out about this. Michigan is currently being sued right now by attorneys representing Sharon Moore's former executive assistant, who are alleging that Michigan is violating the Freedom of Information Act by withholding some documents related to this investigation. The attorney representing Sharon Moore's former assistant has called for the release of the full report, and I think those calls are going to continue. So I think there are a lot of different avenues that this information could come out in various litigation. I think it's going to be very challenging for Michigan to keep this full report private beyond what has come out so far, but I think Michigan certainly will attempt to do that.
Right. What has Manuel himself said about his departure?
Well, he released a short statement on Monday, but I think the more interesting comments were the ones he made last week when the information was first starting to come out about his exit being likely. Ward Manuel really went on the defensive. He spoke to more than one media outlet to dispute reports that he was leaving imminently. It seemed to me like Ward Manuel was really fighting for his legacy and really fighting for the narrative of how this all went down, to say that he's proud of what he accomplished at Michigan. He's proud of the national championships in football and men's basketball and gymnastics, the success of the athletic programs during his time here. And he feels strongly that for the most part, people at Michigan did things the right way. And that statement, you know, that's quite a statement
at the school where Connor Stallions was helping the coaching staff out.
Right. Yeah. Given the long list of scandals that have happened at Michigan, I think a lot of people might argue with that point. But I think from Ward Manuel's perspective, he wants to say that, look, whatever people will say about what happened off the field, there was a lot of success in his tenure, a lot of things to celebrate. And I think he wants to establish that there are things for him to be proud of from his time at Michigan.
Yeah. Maybe it's worth taking a moment and talking about what happened outside the marquee programs. How would you describe successes that Ward Manuel had outside of football and basketball?
Well, Michigan, during Ward Manuel's tenure, I think was one of the most well-rounded athletic departments in college sports. Ward Manuel liked to say Michigan is not just a football school, it's an everything school. Michigan had success in hockey, at one of the premier hockey schools in the country, men's and women's gymnastics, softball, really across the board. There were not a lot of underperforming programs during Ward Manuel's tenure. It's getting harder to do with a lot of the financial pressures in college sports. The fact that schools now have to find $30 to $40 million just to compensate their football rosters, it's a lot harder to have a broad-based athletic department that sponsors as many sports as Michigan sponsors and be successful in all of them. But I think Michigan, for the most part, did pull that off during Ward Manuel's tenure. They had a lot of different athletic programs that reached pretty high levels of success.
Yeah. Austin, do you see the job of athletic directors being in a different place these days? We've talked about how much has changed for coaches in the era of the portal, in the era of name, image, and likeness deals. I wonder if the next person to field this job is going to have a different skill set than what Ward Manuel brought to it.
I think that's exactly right. I think Ward Manuel certainly had his strengths, and one of those strengths was his connection to the Michigan of the past, the Bo Schembechler era. I think a lot of Michigan fans connected with his story as a former Michigan football player, but this is a very different era of college sports. And some of the more traditional impulses at Michigan can come into conflict with the demands of this new era of needing to find money to pay players. And so I think the next athletic director at Michigan is going to need to have some different skills in terms of managing the organizational culture, because that was something that I think Ward Manuel struggled with at times. And also in just being really creative in finding ways to bring in more money for the athletic department to build the most competitive rosters, because that's really the name of the game right now in college sports. How much money can you find to attract the best players? Because the programs that can build the strongest rosters typically are the programs that have the most success. It's really hard to sum up Ward Manuel's whole legacy at Michigan, because it's such a complicated picture. You know, you have to talk about all the success he had, the championships, but you also have to talk about the scandals that really overshadowed, I think, a lot of what happened on the field or on the court at Michigan in recent years. So it felt somewhat inevitable that this would happen, that Michigan would ultimately end up moving on from Ward Manuel. But it's also a little bit jarring, just because he'd been here for more than a decade and was such a constant figure in everything that happened at Michigan over the last decade, both the good and the bad.
Austin Meek writes about Michigan for The Athletic. Austin, thank you so much.
Thanks, April.
Up next, why one of the first library buildings in the nation, built and run entirely by women, is right here in Michigan.
And they did all of that in 1878. And I do find that remarkable, that before women had the vote, that they were able to do these kinds of things.
We'll hear how this group shaped learning and women's civic power in Kalamazoo next. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Whether or not you are a pie baker, this is high season for Michigan's most storied and delicious summer stone fruit, cherries. The latest episode of our podcast, On Hand, is all about the beautiful relationship between Traverse City and cherries. But the story is not complete. Do you have memories of indulging in this bounty? Maybe your family has a particularly good cherry dessert recipe you'd be willing to share with the class? Or is there maybe some off-label way that you use cherries in your cooking that you would tell us about? Drop us a line today. You can email us onhand@michiganpublic.org. Or just head to the On Hand page and you'll find a submission form that is admirably easy to use. You might just hear your story in our next On Hand episode. If you walk past the Ladies Library Association building in Kalamazoo, you might notice the architecture first. Late Venetian Gothic style. It's an eye-catching brick and stone exterior with beautiful stained glass windows. On the second floor, there's an auditorium that has been the site for artistic and cultural events ever since this building opened back in 1878. It's the oldest women's club in Michigan, and the oldest active women's club with open membership in the entire United States. Historian Sharon Carlson joins us now to talk about how this group carved out a place for learning and women's civic power long before its members even had the vote. Sharon Carlson, welcome to Stateside.
Well, hello, April Baer. I am absolutely thrilled to be here.
What was going on in Kalamazoo in 1852 that led a group of women to say, you know what? We should get together.
Well, actually, the real story starts around 1844. And by the 1840s, Kalamazoo was developing as sort of the, you know, it the business community. It was the place for banking. We had, we were a few years past the land office craze, but Kalamazoo was a place in the county where we had a nucleus of a population, and there were women who had experiences maybe back in New York, in New England. Some of them had been teachers. There was a small group of about three or four women. It grew to eight, and for a few years, they would gather in one another's homes, sewing, and one woman would read aloud. And so this is the beginnings of a group that by 1852, when they decide to start the Kalamazoo Ladies Library Association, they are well acquainted with one another. They recognize that educational opportunities are more limited for women and that we don't have a public library in Kalamazoo. And so the initial purpose for forming in 1852 was to organize a subscription-based library. And subscription-based libraries are built on the model that Ben Franklin started with the Library Company of Philadelphia. Essentially, people would buy shares or they would pay a membership fee, dues, and they would have access to the library. And so this this project gets started in 1852. And for 20 years, the Library Association essentially would be Kalamazoo's circulating library. We had a school library, but that was more or less restricted to people who had a relationship with the school, i.e., you know, they had children in the school. And so the women saw this need, and ultimately, you know, it helped the Kalamazoo community, and it also helped it helped the women themselves.
First of all, I just wanted to say, I'm not being flip at all when I say just sitting down and sewing and having someone read to me, that is my idea of a great time. How can I? But this is me reacting to, you know, the craziness of modern life. What would you say the problems were or the needs that these women would have been reacting to when they devised, you know, was it, I mean, the fact that they didn't have a library, it sounded like they just wanted to engage in some quality books for starters.
Well, I think that was absolutely the case because Kalamazoo would have been on the, you know, the Western outpost. And these women came from areas that were probably more settled, more developed. And most of the women who were involved in this organization would have been clearly, I don't know if they would have self-identified as middle or upper middle class women, but most of them were married. They had family responsibilities. And of course, household responsibilities in the 1840s and 1850s were much more onerous than they are today. We take so much more for granted with just a simple task like washing dishes, washing the laundry. So this is the beginnings of a group that by 1852, when they decide to start the Kalamazoo Ladies Library Association, they are well acquainted with one another. They recognize that educational opportunities are more limited for women. They had children to care for. And they found this time to enrich themselves and come together. And we know that there were, in some instances, you know, generations, mothers and daughters, sisters-in-laws. So in some cases, there were, you know, kin relationships among the membership. We also know that Kalamazoo was a much, much smaller community at that time. And so we had literally neighbors, people who were neighbors were members of this club.
Who were some of the key women who would have been involved? Are there, I guess, leading figures in the community?
Well, one that always comes to mind, one of the leading members was a woman named Lucinda Hinsdale Stone. Stone had been born in Vermont in 1814. She actually had family that had moved to the Grand Rapids area by the early 1840s. We had a small educational institution in Kalamazoo that had connections with the University of Michigan, and we had a fairly sizable population of Baptists, and they were interested in a Baptist college. And so they brought Dr. Stone in to really to build the college. So she's one of the early members.
What can you tell us about the historic building that the Ladies' Library came to occupy?
Well, for the first 25 years of the organization's existence, it really was a struggle to find a place. And, you know, they soon have 800-900 books. They collect a number of books fairly quickly. And for the first 2 weeks, they actually operated out of the home of one of their members. This was another family that was involved, the Rice family. There were, I think, a couple of sister-in-laws, and they sponsored the library in their home, and that went well for about 2 weeks. And then it was moved to downtown Kalamazoo Business. For several years, the organization had arrangements with Kalamazoo County. We had space in the county courthouse, and the county supervisors granted the organization space at a very nominal rate, I think a dollar or a couple dollars a year. When the village of Kalamazoo decides to build essentially what is a city hall in the 1860s, two of the rooms are rented to the Kalamazoo Ladies Library Association. And I've often thought they must have thought they arrived. They're in, you know, a beautiful brand new building. And that went on for a few short years. But things were changing in Michigan. And Michigan had library legislation actually predating statehood and provisions for providing, you know, library services even before we become a state in 1837. But by the time the 1870s are coming along, there are more laws making it possible for municipalities to tax and support public libraries.
Sharon, what would it have meant for women to own and operate a public building at that time? I mean, it wasn't that long after the Civil War. Women certainly didn't have full enfranchisement yet.
But they did have some rights. Michigan is an early married women's property law state. As early as 1844, Michigan women, married women, had some right to control some property. Now, did this apply, you know, to all Michigan women? No. Most Michigan women, you know, they didn't inherit property. They didn't bring property into a marriage. They didn't earn funding, you know, they didn't earn salaries. So it didn't apply to most of them. But I do think Michigan women were getting more, I think they were aware that their legal status was starting to change. And the other thing, some of this early library legislation that even predates Michigan statehood, it made provisions for these social and subscription-based libraries. And so, you know, the earliest legislation essentially says, and this applies to groups of men and groups of women, but that people may form organizations for lyceums, for libraries, and then the law spells out, you know, what these groups need to do. And it usually caps the amount of real property they can own. And I think initially it's capped at about $2,000, and then it's $5,000. And so the women of the Ladies Library Association operated under this enabling legislation, you know, for the first 25 years of their existence. And they were always, you know, they operated within that law. However, the building that they constructed was, it exceeded that amount. And when you took into consideration the furnishings and the books and the art, some of which, you know, the books, the furnishings and the art, this had been part of the organization's belongings, their property, you know, even when they had been in rented space. So the women needed to get an act of the Michigan legislature to actually legally own the building. But it wasn't because they were women. It was because they had built a structure that exceeded the cost allowable under law. And I've looked at laws for other organizations, and there are other organizations that found themselves, you know, in the same conundrum, but I've not found any other women's organizations in Michigan. So, I mean, it was remarkable that they exceeded the amount allowable by law. And I think it's even more remarkable that a group of women did this. And what I've always found remarkable is, you know, they were doing this I think we started this conversation, you know, that we are so, you know, mired down in our technology and our screens and everything. Well, the women managed to get a contract with an architect out of Chicago. They managed to work with, managed isn't the right word. You know, they worked with the firm of Bush and Patterson here in Kalamazoo. This was a construction firm that did a lot of Kalamazoo's public buildings, you know, and they did all of that in 1878. And I do find that remarkable that before women had the vote, that they were able to do these kinds of things.
How would you say the mission of the library evolved into the 20th century?
Well, obviously, the coming of the Kalamazoo Public Library meant that the subscription aspect was not as needed as before. And in fact, in my research of the records, the membership drops quite a bit at that point. But this is happening at the same time that a larger women's club movement is building in the U.S., like the New England Women's Club and such. And so for several years, and the library functioned, it never went away, but for several years, we had a literary arm with, I would call it a study club, where women researched topics, they presented papers, and, you know, they did this in a community of women. And this was a tremendous self-educational tool that the women took advantage of. And I think, you know, was what we don't have. We don't always know what did it mean to these women, because most of them didn't keep diaries, even though we know what the program topics were and we know who was giving the paper. You know, these accounts are in newspapers and in some of the records of the Kalamazoo Ladies Library Association. But we can only speculate, you know, the empowerment that these activities would have brought the women. And of course, the women's club movement is, it's a huge movement that continues well into the 20th century. It still continues today. I think it's much changed from what it once was, but that's how it evolved.
How would you say that the work of the library is related to the Kalamazoo that we see before us today and what the association has become?
Well, like any association, in order to be relevant, you need to know what the issues are. You need to keep current. And the Ladies Library Association, I think, has done that. We no longer have a circulating library, but we still have programs where they are offered for member enrichment. We are a community partner in the arts, and we regularly collaborate with groups like, you know, the Kalamazoo Arts Council, the Gilmore Piano Festival, and, you know, our venue, this 1879 building that we operate from, when it was originally constructed, the women viewed it as having a public purpose. And I think in recent years, we've tried to bring that public purpose back, because we have an auditorium on the second floor, which seats 99. So we can't have large gatherings. So I think that's a way we've continued to stay relevant. I think the people that join the organization and stay with the organization soon find out it is a place where I seldom have my phone out. I have met some of the most interesting people. Our membership now is about 170 to 175 members, but I would say we have an active core, maybe of 50 to 60 that regularly come to teas, come to lunches. And in the past, our membership, I'd started our conversation by, you know, talking about that these were women who were, they were wives, they were mothers, and we still have, you know, wives and mothers, but our organization probably skews a little bit older today. We have members ranging in age from about age 20 to 101, but most of us are in our 60s, 70s, and 80s. And for a lot of us, we've had careers. And so, you know, I know retired nurses, corporate executives, people who were in law enforcement. It really runs the gamut. And so what I have found, and I found this in my own circle of friends too, that a lot of us didn't get involved in women's clubs until we were a little bit older because we were so busy with our careers, with our families and such. And so I think a club is a good place if you're recently retired and maybe you put your all into your work or your family. Maybe you could meet some new friends. So it's about friendship. It's about connections. And of course, we're trying to do good things for the community too. Our major philanthropic activity is a program we've been involved in for about 35 years called Books for Babies, where we collect books and for children up through about age 5, and we distribute them to 20 partner agencies. And we do that distribution several times a year.
Sharon Carlson is a history librarian and a regional historian for Kalamazoo. She's also one of the Kalamazoo Ladies Libraries Association's past presidents. Sharon, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We noticed on the association's calendar that the LLA still holds regular tea times every month. You can check out the Ladies Library Association website for more information. It's time for a break now. After that, prospects for getting a summer job if you're 18 or younger.
The lack of experience they get when we've got a weaker economy ends up shaping them for a lifetime.
We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We are right smack in the middle of the summer, which means that many teenagers across the state are busy working at their summer jobs. But unlike the 1970s, teens today are navigating a more difficult labor market, burdened by artificial intelligence, an up-and-down economy, and some higher unemployment rates. We asked a few teens from West Michigan to tell us what their search has been like.
My name is Jayla Corporan. I am 16 years old.
My first and last name are Marco Villa. I am 16.
My name is Leonardo Arvizu. I'm 14 years old as of today.
I tried getting a job at Taco Bell. Went to a few different interviews. They kept rescheduling, saying, oh, sorry, you know, manager's not here. Come back this time.
For most of them, I didn't get a interview. It was just, like, the automated email. We're not looking for, like, people right now, or you didn't meet our qualifications.
And I'd have to keep calling the store over and over to, like, get any sort of, like, clarity of what I'm doing, you know?
I do have, like, experience in just kind of like the food industry. So like when I would do interviews for like fast food restaurants, like I would mention that and some of them wouldn't hire me.
I've heard like the same stories from my friends where they like they apply thousands, you know, places and they just can't get it, you know, a job anywhere. Obviously not thousands, but you know.
I would say it was pretty tough, at least in my experience.
The job market right now in general is like very like bad, you know, it's hard to get a job anywhere.
Maybe it was just the time, but there wasn't a lot of places hiring, and especially when you're under 16, it's just a lot more limitations.
I had been applying for like jobs, I want to say like a month prior to me being hired at the job that I'm currently at now, and it wasn't really easy because like a lot of jobs weren't getting back to me.
Getting a job in general, like my mom, even though she's like very qualified and has lots of experience, she spent like lots of time, like, you know, between jobs, like, you know, having no time, you know, not having a job.
I found a job at a Korean street food place in Holland.
Currently, I work at Tommy Hilfiger at the Tanger outlet. I think the main reason I got the job was not only because, like, my friend referred me, but also because they were looking for someone that speaks Spanish.
They, like, kind of hired me on the spot. I honestly think it was because they were severely understaffed.
Well, throughout my entire interview process, I remember my employer telling me that he really liked my professionalism.
They paid me $13.75 per hour.
I think per paycheck it's somewhere around $500.
What I've heard from a lot of my friends, they typically don't ever make like over $12 an hour. Most places only typically pay minors about $11 or $12 an hour.
If you have any ideas of where to apply, like you know where you're applying and stuff. Also, just being able to, it's like really hard, just be confident and be like, know what you can do, know your limits, and don't just do the first option.
I think really the best places to apply are places that aren't like near schools or like easily accessible areas to like, for like, you know, high school, or like the Tanger outlet isn't necessarily close to any school or like walking distance to really like big residential areas, so like not as many high schoolers apply there since not everyone tribes, you know?
In the work field, always just know who you are and always know when to say no and when to say, like, when to stand up for yourself because jobs are gonna be here forever. You just gotta make sure that you're okay first before you do anything.
That was 14-year-old Leo Arvizo, 16-year-olds Jayela Corporan, and Marco Villa from West Michigan. Right now, data from the state tells us that Michigan teens are finding it more difficult to land summer jobs compared with 3 years ago. The Bureau of Labor Statistics counted more than 200,000 fewer teens working this May compared with last May. All this comes as Michigan's legislature is considering a bill that would no longer require teens under the age of 16 to get a work permit before they start jobs. We've invited University of Michigan economist Betsy Stevenson to talk to us about this. Hey, Betsy, welcome back.
It is great to talk with you today.
So there are many ways to look at employment, and we kind of started in on this question with state data, you know, for what's going on over the summer. Can you maybe walk us through some top line numbers? If we say that there is an 18% teen unemployment forecast for summer 26 at the state level, what might that translate to?
Well, you know, that is a very typical unemployment rate for teens. And so, first of all, it just takes a little bit of time to find the right job. So at the time of the survey, they might be looking for work, but maybe a couple weeks later, they've actually found work.
Oh, wait. So this is like adults. Like the unemployment rate has to take into account not just who's working, but who's looking for work and who's not looking for work.
Right. So the unemployment rate is the share of teens who are available for work and actively looking for work. So, you know, it's actually a hopeful sign when we see a high number because that means a lot of teens are trying to find work. So then we want to compare that to what share of them are actually working. And not all teens are looking for work or working. And the unemployment rate can be affected by both things, the teens' desire to find work, so their efforts to get out there and find work, as well as it being tough to find work. I think early in the summer, there was a lot of feeling that it would be a tough summer to find work. But when this recent data just came out in July, what we saw was that in June, when we look at teens, and by teens, I mean 16 to 19 years old nationally, we are seeing that it just doesn't look that much worse than it did, you know, exactly 1 year ago. In fact, it looks a little bit better in terms of the share that were employed in June. You know, most of the time when we're talking about adults, we want to do things like seasonally adjust the data, which means I want to adjust for the fact that more people work at certain times of the year. Otherwise, we would all get confused by all these seasonal patterns. But when it comes to teens, you might just want to know, like, what share of teens, 16 to 19-year-olds, are working or were working in June when the surveyor came around. And what we saw there was it was 34.4%, so a little over a third. And you might think, wait, that's pretty low. But actually, it is a little bit higher than it was in June of last year. And it's a lot higher than it was in May. So in May, we saw only 30% on a non-seasonally adjusted basis. So I do think we saw, you know, just a, you know, you, that's the process. In May, there's sort of kids looking for work, May and June, and then they find work and we start to see it tick up. So we're going to want to take a look at the data again in August that show what happened in July. And that's going to be the real answer. For a lot of teens, this is all coming down to what's happening in leisure and hospitality. Our adults going on vacation and out to dinner, because that's where a lot of the team work comes from in the summertime.
I was going to ask how good you feel the tools are that we use to measure teen employment. Are they as reliable as the metrics that we use to measure like hospitality and service industry overall?
So first of all, when we're looking at industries, like when we're looking at hospitality overall, there what we're doing is we're surveying companies and we're asking them who they have on payroll. And so in fact, there's a little bit of a juxtaposition, because when we looked at this labor report that just came out about what was going on in June, we saw a pretty big decline in hiring in leisure and hospitality, right? It lost 61,000 jobs. Most of those were in accommodation and food services. That does not bode well for the summer. That doesn't bode well for teen work. So then why did that not show up in teen employment? Well, that's a different survey. The companies that tell us about their payrolls don't have any characteristics of the age or the gender of their workers. So what we do is we go out and we talk to households, and we often talk to the head of the household. So April, I might ask you, do you have any teenagers in your home and are they looking for work?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, April, you might hope your teen is looking for work and so say they're looking for work, but maybe they're not actually looking that hard.
Or as a mother, I may say, she's not looking for work.
And she may be applying to a lot of different jobs that you don't know about because she doesn't want to tell you about them until she hears something back. I think that the fact that the teen is usually not going to be the person filling out the survey, and as soon as they're in school, they're no longer available for fully available for work, and we don't count them as among the unemployed. You know, the May data is kind of awkward because there are not a lot of teens, you know, that are out of school in May. There's not even not a lot of teens that are necessarily completely done with school in June when the survey week happens. And so July is going to be our, you know, I think the big reveal about how teens did this summer. Because if we see a lot of teens in work in July, then that's the heart of teen work.
Is there any reason to think that there may be a long-term structural shift in youth labor markets?
Absolutely. So I am really glad you raised this point, because the other thing we don't measure is how good the jobs are for teens. We often talk about that for adults, like, are you in a good job? Does it, you know, were we thinking about benefits? For teens, what I want to think about is, are you in a job that's teaching you really important skills? And those skills are building your work readiness. They're building, you know, your human capital, your labor, what you're going to be able to take to the next job. And some jobs do a better job of building skills than others. And that doesn't mean, like, I think a lot of the job of summer job for kids is teaching them how to be on a schedule, how to listen to a boss, how to do weird things that make no sense to them because their boss says they need to do them. You know, like I had a teen say to me the other day, you know, you can't just have a snack whenever you feel like one when you're at work.
What?
Whoa, mind blown. And so, you know, you can't just go to the bathroom whenever you want. Like if you have a customer at the register, you like,
my heart.
these are important skills. So I don't want to overplay the idea that there's not as many like corporate internships necessarily. But I do think that we don't have a good handle on the types of skills teens are learning in the workplace. And I do think we have a structural problem with entry-level jobs right now. And those entry-level jobs, I think, are more important, not when we're necessarily talking about the 16-year-old trying to get a summer job before they go back for their junior or senior year of high school, but when we're talking about the 18-year-old that just graduated, that's maybe trying to build a skill set because they're not ready to go on to college and they want to really get a foot in the door at an entry-level job, or the college graduate who just graduated and is trying to get their first real adult entry-level job. And They're finding that they're basically doing the same jobs that they were doing during the summer when they were a student, a high school student or a college student. And that is the bigger question around, how, I think teens often get caught in a slowing labor market. And we are clearly in a low fire labor market. Employers seem very reluctant to hire people. They seem to have less of a need for entry-level tasks. And what that means is that entry-level office job is like just that seems to be a real hole for a lot of young people right now. And even the summer job, a lot of companies or businesses might take a teen during the summer because you want the teen to do some very basic things. And, a lot of that is being has been replaced by artificial intelligence, as well as companies just cutting corners. And so you put that all together, and it's certainly changing the shape of the labor market that teens are facing. And I think our data does not do a very good job of telling us about that.
Is there any reason why Michigan's teens might be in a different situation than anyone else in the rest of the country? It looks like national teen unemployment moved from 10.5% to 14.1% over the same period that those state numbers I referred to before we were talking about.
Well, I don't know that it would be anywhere else in the rest of the country, but what you see is that labor markets do differ all around the country, right? If you think about what's going on right now with oil and gas prices, that's not great for the state of Michigan. It's pretty darn good for the state of Texas. And so, if you are a teen in Texas, you may be having a very different experience than a teen in Michigan. So what we, a lot of teen jobs depend on the local spending of the adults around them. And so if the economy is booming for the adults, then the adults are going to want a lot of, summer childcare help and restaurants and leisure and hotels. If the adults around them are cutting back because the economy is weakening, then there's going to be less demand for those services. So, teens are often the first place to cut your budget. And I think what's, always so challenging for young people is that the lack of experience they get when we've got a weaker economy ends up shaping them for a lifetime. There's a whole literature that shows that if you graduate into a recession, it can take decades before you catch up to your peers who didn't graduate in a recession. And that doesn't necessarily mean a recession, just a national recession can mean, your local economy is much worse. We do think people have the ability to move, but obviously teens do not. So, there are lots of places in the country right now where there is, lower unemployment than there is in Michigan. Michigan is one of the higher unemployment states right now. But it's not like teens are going to get up and necessarily, move to Indiana
Or Illinois,
even,
yeah, or
or
Ohio,
Illinois,
yeah.
which have, or Wisconsin, which have overall, lower unemployment rates right now, or, Maine has a very low unemployment rate, it getting overall for adults. But when you see an unemployment rate, in Maine of 3.1% or New Hampshire of 3.0%, there's going to be a lot of space for teens to find a job compared to Michigan, where the unemployment rate for adults was 5.1%. Those numbers sound small, but that's, a two-thirds higher, I guess, is a way to think about it. There's almost twice as many people unemployed in Michigan, as in Maine. When you have a high adult unemployment rate, you're going to have older people competing with teens for the exact same job.
Professor Betsy Stevenson of the University of Michigan. She teaches public policy and economics. Betsy, thank you so much.
It's great talking with you today, April.
That's all for Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Great having you with us. See you next time.